The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. My name is Morris Williams, and it is my privilege to welcome you once again to a lovely, informative evening at the Free Library of Philadelphia. I urge you to buy James Comey's new book, Central Park West. It is a real page-turner. I was fortunate to get an early copy, and I was immediately captured by the development of the characters, and I think it's a superb book. Mr. Comey, in addition to the material that's in the book cover that you will find, was educated at the College of William and Mary and then went on to the University of Chicago Law School. You know, he's been both a prosecutor, a defense lawyer, general counsel, head of the FBI, and a teacher. And I asked him which of the jobs he enjoyed the most. And his answer was being a prosecutor. And so you may want to explore that, as well as the fact that he and his wife have five children, and they have all followed, his wife was a school teacher, and they have all followed their parents into public service, ranging from being a policeman to being a prosecutor in the Southern District in New York, where he spent a number of years, and which he headed that office on a second tour of duty, and also as public school teachers. We're fortunate that tonight Jim Comey is going to be interviewed by Philadelphia's own George Anastasia, who I think most of you will know is a highly regarded expert on crime, has written extensively for the Inquirer about crime and other areas, and he himself was once exposed to a mafia threat on his life. So he's experiencing that. And so without further ado, let's give a warm Philadelphia welcome to Jim Comey and George Anastasia.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming. We're going to talk a little bit up here, and then we're going to have a Q&A from the audience. But I wanted to open by asking Jim. You know, there are two worlds that you write about, the world of organized crime and the world of politics, and there doesn't seem to be that much difference. And I wondered if I know you're not making it up because I'm familiar with it, but what's your take on all that? How does it intersect? How does it reflect each other?
Yeah, so first of all, thank you for doing this. Thank you all for being here. I look forward to our conversation. You know, as well as anyone alive, the world of Cosa Nostra, and it's an organization that talks about, aspires to values, talks about principles, but is essentially an amoral organization. And the leadership is focused entirely on the boss. It's all about what can you flow up to me, what taste can you give me of all the rackets we're involved in. And so it becomes entirely about personal loyalty and not about what's right or wrong. Obviously, it's a criminal organization, but about this, me, the boss, the center of me. And so political life isn't always like that, but it ebbs and flows, I think. Given the nature of people, you sometimes find yourself in environments that resemble those. And I've seen that. I not to get political right, I guess I'm about to get political right off the bat, but I had a very strange reaction to my first encounter with our former president, and I kept thinking of that, of Cosa Nostra.
Sure, yeah.
And I got a little talk with myself. I said, you're being dramatic. Remember where I was. I was at Trump Tower sitting in a conference room, and I didn't have a lead role, so I got a chance to look around. The director of national intelligence had the lead role, director of CIA, myself, and the director of the National Security Agency. We all had speaking parts, but I could watch for a bit of it. And as I watched, I kept having this image pop in my head. And I pushed it away and pushed it away and pushed it away. But as time went on, I came to realize what I hope most of us have come to realize, that I was feeling something real.
You're at a sit-down.
Yeah, and I was feeling that kind of culture, that kind of leadership culture.
Yeah.
It's about me. It's about what you can do for me. It's about what how you're giving me a piece. What's that about?
It seems it's greed, power, and wealth. But how do we get away from that? You're painting pictures in the book and telling a story, but what's the point that you want to convey to the reader in that context?
First of all, I want to show the readers what it's really like inside a high-stakes investigation. I want to show them what it's really like in these courtrooms. And because I found it, and I hope you all will find it reading this, really exciting to do this work. And oftentimes I think in fiction, the excitement comes from investigators or prosecutors breaking the law or going rogue in some way. And my experience is most of them want to do the right thing in the right way, and there's real excitement in that. So I want to show what it's really like, and I want to show what the people are like in two respects. I want to show that the prosecutors and the investigators are trying, they're flawed people, as I am. They're trying to do the right thing. But I'm also trying to show the nature and character of the people that they have to interact with, who are a combination of both good and bad. And I want to show the difficult division between truth and justice. Right. They're different things in the criminal justice system.
Yeah, I mean, that was another point that struck me is the system, when it works, is not necessarily about finding the truth. It's about finding justice, and they're not always the same thing.
Yeah.
Is that okay? Can we function that way?
Yeah, I think we have to. It took me a while to realize that. As a young prosecutor, I'm not sure I saw the difference between truth and justice so clearly, and as I got more experienced, I realized that sometimes you can know something. In your heart of hearts, know something to be true, and I've seen it in horrible cases. I've been involved in situations where I knew someone was a killer, was a serial killer, but I couldn't make the case. I couldn't find the forensic evidence I needed, and so it was agony to realize that what is true doesn't necessarily allow me to achieve justice. And I think we want it that way because humans are so flawed that we really want a hurdle that they have to meet with admissible evidence beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury of 12 who must unanimously agree. That's a really high standard. That's a protection against the innocent being convicted, although that still happens, unfortunately. But it is a recipe for sometimes bad guys getting away with it. And so I don't want to give anything away in this book, but I try to show that in reality.
Yeah, I mean, I've covered a lot of trials, and it can be exciting. If you get into the rhythm of a trial and the story that the prosecutor is telling, it's an art. And likewise with the defense attorneys. I wanted to throw out one thing that a lot of little things struck me here, and I'm looking around the audience. If I don't know how many folks here remember the old TV show Queen for a Day. Some of you remember that? There's a term in the system, a proffer session, when somebody wants to cut a deal. And talk about that, and they call it being queen for a day. Why is that? And
yeah.
You know, you've got that.
We've in a more aware era. I think we've tried to move away from that particular term.
Right.
But what it is it gives somebody protection for immediate use against them of their statements. It's a way the dance begins, where someone who wants to consider cooperating with the government and the government prosecutors and investigators who might entertain cooperation from this defendant get to taste a little of the cooking without going in too deep. And so what a Queen for a Day agreement provides is you'll sit down and talk to us, and this meeting will be governed by this contract. And the contract is this: we won't use what you say directly against you unless later you contradict these statements, or sometimes it says we can use it as leads to other evidence. But it's basically to give a protection around a particular meeting so we as prosecutors can decide whether you are someone who might be telling the truth and you can get a sense of us.
What about the use of informants? I mean, and that's something else that I see again and again, defense attorneys constantly hammering at. You've made a deal with the government. You're going to say whatever the government wants you to say. And should the government be making deals with the devil? As a prosecutor, and the book gets into some of that. There's a couple interesting informants here. How do you deal with that? And what's your, I guess the moral question is, should we be doing that? When did we decide to do that? Can we do it?
It's a really hard question because if you're pursuing really bad people, the problem with really bad people is they don't surround themselves with good people. And so if you're going to find out what went on in a Cosa Nostra meeting or maybe in a meeting at, you know, in a government office,
right.
and if that leader has chosen, has attracted and retained people of questionable character, that's your only choice.
Yeah.
And so there's a necessity to it. And we always used to say to juries, look, it'd be great if I could call, I don't know, a priest or a rabbi in here to tell me about, you know, this, you know, Joe's conduct. But he doesn't hang out with priests and rabbis. He hangs out with a bunch of criminals.
There was a prosecutor in Philadelphia who used the line, swans don't swim in sewers.
Okay.
I mean, when you cover many trials, a lot of this almost becomes cliche because prosecutors and defense attorneys use the same speeches. It's just it's a new jury and it's a new case, but you hear the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, if I'd heard that, I would have used it, though. Yeah, swans and sewers. I got to tell my kids that because they'll be able to use that.
That's a good one, yeah.
But look, it's a necessity, but it's dangerous. And I used to train prosecutors and tell them, every cooperating witness is a loaded gun pointed at you and your career and this office. Because they have incentives to lie, especially in Cosa Nostra cases. They're only alive because they're manipulative. They're only alive because they look around and they make alliances and they can lie well. That's how they've survived. There's a Darwinian aspect to getting to the top of a mafia organization. And so you have to realize you cannot trust this person. And it's really hard when you spend a ton of time with people. I spend a lot of time in small rooms with really bad people.
Yeah.
And they're funny. And they love their families, and they want to talk sports. And so there's a connection that develops. And you can forget who's there. Because I also, having spent a lot of time with people who killed a lot of people, I used to tell my kids, I'm really a depressing dad, but I used to tell my kids, never forget evil has an ordinary face. Right? I can remember some of my mob witnesses. One of them had killed 38 people.
Right.
He'd actually killed 37, he told us. Then when he got on the witness stand, he remembered he had actually killed two people by the same name, two guys named Pino D'Amico. And so he's like, through a translator, it was a Sicilian. Through a translator, he says, one moment. I killed two men named Pino D'Amico. And so I spent a lot of time with that guy. A depressing thing is, no music plays when you're with somebody like that.
Yeah.
The light doesn't change. You're across from a human being. And they'll all tell you the same thing, which is, the first time I killed someone, it was really, really hard.
Yeah.
After that, not so much. But what you come to realize is they're people. They're philosophical turns, they're sad. And so you can be drawn in, and that can lead to abuse. And so you try to train prosecutors well to know how to deal with cooperators. And also remember that because there's all kinds of moral peril, you got to work up. You never want to be flipping and giving the benefits of a cooperation to a higher up to go get the underlings, because you're then spending the government's credibility and its power needlessly. So it's a really dangerous thing. Incredibly important, though, to the criminal justice system. But you see it all the time. You may see it if cases are brought against former leaders of this country who will then argue that the witnesses aren't credible. And the other thing we would argue, I'm sure you've heard this, is, yeah, this witness is a terrible person. Is he my friend? No.
We didn't choose him.
He's the defendant's friend. Yeah. Who's he been hanging out with for 35 years? Yeah. The defendant. He chose him.
Given that background and given your experience there, how did you react when the former president was complaining about flippers? I mean, when I heard him talking about that, it to me it was an echo of a lot of wise guys who have said the same thing to me. Flippers, this is not right, shouldn't be. And we had the highest office in the land saying, this is not right. This is not the way the system ought to work.
He called, not to jump on him, but he also called them rats.
Yeah.
And so he echoes in a lot of ways the language of Cosa Nostra. And so my reaction was, not a shocker, here's someone who doesn't really care about the rule of law because they're not rats. They're not flippers. They're people who have pled guilty, admitted their culpability, and in exchange for the opportunity to have the judge reduce their sentence, are testifying truthfully at a trial. And you call them rats only to try and discourage them from testifying, to rattle them and to rattle their families. And even though they're strong people, they're rattleable, right? Because
sure, yeah.
They don't want to be in that spot. And I mean, one of the things I tell about in the book, I try to draw from my real experiences in the book. I had a witness who was a world-class art thief who testified against a bunch of mobsters for me. And as he walked into the courtroom, one of them mouthed, "You're dead." And I didn't see it because I was standing at the podium and the judge didn't see it. But I looked at my witness's face and all of a sudden it had changed. And I was trying to pull his testimony out of him, pull it out of him. And I decided to try and capture that in this story. So I went back to the actual trial transcripts. Right. So the dialogue in there, it's kind of real fiction. It happened. But they're not, they will feign tough guys in a lot of ways, but you can rattle them with language like that and with intimidation like that.
Yeah. There was a situation in Philadelphia once where they were making the sign of the gun to a witness when he was on the same kind of thing, trying to intimidate the witness before he got up.
Yep.
And shake him up.
And bringing in family members.
Yeah.
I mean, The Godfather actually, in my experience, shaped Cosa Nostra instead of the reverse. Life ended up imitating art.
It's a training film.
Yeah.
For second and third generation Italian Americans who were gangsters. It was a training film. I
mean, And especially because we're about to start talking shop here, but they couldn't. The Godfather came out at a time when Cosa Nostra was not in accepting new members.
Yeah, right.
And so I can remember one of my witnesses saying, "I wanted in so bad, but I couldn't get in because they'd closed the books."
Yeah.
And so I went and saw that movie, and I walked out. I remember him saying this. He said, "I walked out on 18th Avenue in Brooklyn. I remember the sun hitting my face as I walked out of the movie, and I thought, that's the life." Well, of course, it wasn't really the life,
right.
But they started talking that way and acting that way.
Yeah.
So when they were finally inducted, Francis Ford Coppola and Mario Puzo had influenced the American mafia.
Yeah, absolutely. It, that generation. The other thing that this book is heavy on is strong women, whether it's the prosecutor, whether it's the hit woman, whatever. Where does that come from, and what were your thought process in writing about that?
I'm surrounded by them in my life, in a good way. I don't mean criminals, but strong women. I have four strong, smart, tall daughters. My wife is not tall, but she's smart and strong. And so they've shaped my view of the world for the better. I'm a continuing project for them, but I'm a better person for being surrounded by them and seeing the world more clearly. And so I'll tell you the story. I was working on this book, and I originally intended the protagonist to be a guy. And while I was working on this, I was thinking about my experience as a prosecutor, and I wanted to draw on experiences I'd had in a particular case, prosecuting the Gambino brothers in the old federal courthouse in Lower Manhattan, and we did it in courtroom 318. And so I was imagining scenes that would be in courtroom 318. And here's where life has weird crossovers. While I was doing that work, my oldest daughter was the chief of the Violent and Organized Crime Unit in the Southern District of New York, U.S. Attorney's Office, standing in the same courtroom, courtroom 318, because she had indicted Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, and Epstein had gotten away, had killed himself, but she was prosecuting literally on her feet Maxwell, and I wanted to go to watch, and she forbid me. Because she said, "Dad, if you go, it'll be a thing." And I'm not even sure what that is, but it's not good. And so my wife got to go, and I was banned and got reports secondhand. And so all of a sudden it became obvious the protagonist has to be a woman. And so I based Nora Carlton on my oldest daughter, Maureen, but also on my other three girls. It's not exactly Maureen, but I've tried to draw from all of them. And it did something to me in the writing because it wasn't about me. All of a sudden, it was a labor of love. And I'm telling a story, and I'm picturing my daughter and trying to channel her and capture her, and it made it addictive for me.
Right. And in the real world today, in law enforcement and in the underworld, I mean, I think women play a bigger role in law enforcement than they did 20 years ago. In the underworld, I don't see it. But one of the central figures here in the book is a woman. We're not giving too much away.
Yeah, I got strong women who are good.
Right.
As Nicole Wallace said, the good guys and the bad guys are women.
Yeah.
I said, yeah. And I'm trying to capture something. I don't want to give too much away.
But the other thing that struck me, we're talking about honor and loyalty and rules of law. The woman gangster here does have a code that she lives by. And there's a couple situations in the book where she's got a rogue half-brother that's gone off the reservation, and she's approached by an investigator, and she brings him back in line.
Yeah, she tries to act in accordance with principles. And what I'm trying to capture there is something you know really well. You know, all people want to tell ourselves we're doing things that have meaning and purpose and principle. And mob people really were. In my experience, people who would tell themselves, I'm a soldier, right? I'm a warrior. I mean, I once had a mafia hitman who was on trial pass me a note, and I thought it was him trying to flip. In fact, it might have been, but it didn't work out. But I opened the note, and it said I'd gotten a recognition from the Bar Association in New York during this six-month trial, and it said, "Dear Mr. Comey, I read of your award. It is well-deserved," and signed his name. And so why did he do that? I think because he fancies himself, I'm a warrior. Mm. You're a warrior. I respect my opponent. Yeah. And so it was a way of almost giving himself dignity. And I saw that a lot with Cosa Nostra people. And some of them really believed the principles and rules. For others, they were like the rules against fighting in hockey, you know, where they're on the books, but we don't really abide those rules. And it's a way, I think, of them convincing themselves, this life I've chosen is a life of principle and purpose.
Yeah, there's a very simple line toward the end of the book where the hit woman says, "We keep our promises," which kind of encapsulates that whole, her mindset of who she was and what she was about.
Yeah, and there still are people like that, and were a lot of people in that world like that. I mean, I joke about the rules, but my personal favorite of the rules of Cosa Nostra is in the United States is we don't harm law enforcement.
Right.
And that's not because of any moral judgment. That's because they did not have that rule in the Sicilian Mafia and still don't. And the difference is explained, in my opinion, by the power of the state. That if you harm law enforcement in the United States, we will crush you. It'll take us a while to get organized, but the state is so large. The police departments are so large. I remember being in a case, a guy named Gus Faraci, probably accidentally killed a DEA agent named Everett Hatcher in New York in 1988. And the moment Special Agent Hatcher was killed, a race began to find the killer, us and Cosa Nostra. Right. And they found him first, and he was shot in the face with an automatic weapon on the street and left on the street as a message.
Right.
And lots of cops and agents were told thereafter, this is done, right?
Yeah.
We took care of this. And so they're really, and in Sicily, of course, the reverse is true, that they killed prosecutors and law enforcement with impunity because they could. But here the rule was self-interested, but I'm not against that rule.
Yeah. Another thing that you deal with is, and we saw it down here a lot as well, organized crime and disorganized law enforcement, different agencies competing with one another to get the glory. And sometimes it screws up a case, and you address that here. But is that, I'm assuming that comes from actual experience as well.
Yeah. I mean, Philadelphia has all kinds of turf challenges.
Right.
I would argue that New York City is worse in lots of ways than Philadelphia, but especially when it comes to that. Because you have this weird setup. New York City is the only city in the country with two federal districts on opposite ends of the Brooklyn Bridge. And the FBI is by far the largest FBI field office and the country's largest police department. So you've got all kinds of King Kong, Godzilla setups there. And then you have not just two aggressive U.S. attorney's offices. You've got great local prosecutor's offices right next door. I try to capture this. The Manhattan DA is right next door, basically right next door to the U.S. attorney's office. So you've got all these talented people who want to make these cases. And so I tried to explain our relationship when I was the U.S. attorney with the DA's office and the FBI's relationship when I was director with the NYPD, with the same expression, I would say, we're blood-sworn enemies unless we're living together and having a baby. There were times when we cooperated really well. Terrorism is a great example. But there are times when we stepped on each other in an effort to compete with each other, which is and so we'd have to have sit-downs to resolve this. And so then I get promoted to be the number two at the Department of Justice, so I oversee everybody, literally everyone in the Department of Justice reported to the Deputy Attorney General. And a huge part of my time is refereeing these sit-downs. Yeah. But they come in because the FBI's pissed, the DEA's doing this, and they can't get this done, and so I'd have to make a decision to resolve it, like a Cosa Nostra boss. And so I used to think that if I were king, I would try to resolve some of that by, say, only having one federal district in the city. And I decided, you know what? Once I saw the whole country, I like the competition. I think on balance, we're better for the police department wanting to be better than the FBI, even though there's friction and cost there.
Right. Well, and you were the Southern District of New York.
Yeah.
Down here in Philadelphia, when there was conflict, they referred to you as the Sovereign District of New York.
Yeah.
Because you guys were the 500-pound gorilla.
Yeah, we were a huge pain in the rear end. Yeah. And with this aggressive, I didn't know this, that I was stepping into a strange culture. Strange in some wonderful ways, I guess. But the Southern District of New York's concept of venue, which means, so what activity can we reach with our powers, really is this. Did it happen on the Earth?
Yeah.
And if it happened on the Earth, I mean, you're going to think I'm making this story up? When I was U.S. attorney, I indicted Russian mobsters who were working in northern Italy to bribe a French judge to fix the ice dancing at the Salt Lake City Olympics.
Yeah.
And I can remember the press conference was carried live on ESPN, which for a sports person I was really excited about. And I remember the question coming from one of the journalists saying, just reciting what I just told you all and saying, so why are we here in Manhattan? And my exact answer was, you mean other than our longtime commitment to ice dancing? But that's the attitude of that place. And where we really saw turf battles was over OC work.
Yeah.
Right?
Sure.
Because the Philadelphia mob overlapped a lot with the New York families. Yeah. They worked together. And so Philadelphia has had and still has very strong prosecutions. And so they was, especially the U.S. Attorney's Office, they had talented people. They'd want to do the work. And so there'd be battles. And I'm forgetting, we'd step over the poor people in Newark who wanted to do a piece of both of our work.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and you capture a lot of that in the book. I mean, the book to me was fascinating because I saw the insider information that was coming out, and it made the narrative work from my perspective. Other question I have is, and this is something very current, the weaponizing of the Justice Department. And I find it rather ironic that a former president who used the IRS to go after his own enemies is complaining about weaponizing the Justice Department when it seemed to be part of his toolkit. How, as part of the Justice Department, how do you deal with that? How do you function in that kind of situation?
Yeah, it's first of all, it's crazy and it's hard. Although if my wife were here, she would say, make sure you remind them that we were audited after I was fired.
Yeah.
And although I did get a $357 refund after I was audited, it cost me $5,000 in accounting fees to realize that I had overpaid my taxes. And so what are you going to do? But the notion, first of all, the weaponization of the Department of Justice, the notion that the FBI is a left-leaning, liberal organization out to target Republicans is so nuts that it's only possible today to say that, right? That in our environment, that grown-ups could stand up and say that about the FBI. The FBI has many challenges, many strengths, and many weaknesses. One of them is not that it's a leftist organization. And so how do you deal with that? All we can do is stand up, all of us, and try to speak truth into that maelstrom. Mm-hmm. Try to make sure that we don't just become numb to it, because the risk for someone like me, that you're like, oh my gosh, it's so crazy. Who's going to buy that? People believe the lies. And so it's really important that all of us who know the work speak about what it's really like and expose the absurdity of this idea that the FBI is out there targeting Republicans or Democrats.
Yeah.
So the FBI is going to be fine in the long run, because at bottom, the American people, there's a sound identity that's been established with the American people. It'll be okay. But even a diminution in trust has real effects, right? The FBI has to be able to say to someone, if you tell us about this child exploitation ring that you've been drawn into, we will protect you. You can trust us. To say to a cooperating witness in a public corruption case, we are the good people. You can tell us the truth. Stand up in front of a jury and say, I saw this, I found this, I heard this. And if they're seen as this group or that group, instead of a group that's just trying to figure out what's true, it's harder to do the right thing for the American people. So there's costs, even though I believe in the long run it'll be okay.
In terms of law and justice, the basic premise is we all have to play by the rules. And it seems that Cosa Nostra has always broken the rules to their own end. But it seems to me, and you get into this in the political aspects in this book, the rules don't really matter. What matters is the end game, to get to where you want to go. And so the rules can be bent or broken. Is that a reflection of society in general, or is it, you know, where do we stand today? I mean, and I don't want to make a speech, but I mean, if a particular political party played by the rules, either Merrick Garland would be on the Supreme Court or Coney Barrett wouldn't be on the Supreme Court. The rules just get changed to fit the dynamic situation that we're in. How do you deal with that?
The same way we deal with false statements about law enforcement, we just have to not get tired of pointing it out. That, and especially making sure the young people understand that rules matter, that they're real, and that the rule of law especially is a real thing. I mean, I think an under-recognized, maybe under-reported story is one of the sources of my optimism about America. The rule of law overwhelmingly has held in this country. Think about the onslaught of lies after the 2020 election. Those were heard in county courts, city courts, state courts, federal courts. And the rule of law held, because the rule of law is not just rules, but it's embedded within a culture where certain things are not okay. You can say anything you want standing in front of Four Seasons Total Landscaping with hair dye running down your face, right? You can say anything you want. You can lie your rear end off. But you step into a courtroom, don't you dare. Because there are real consequences to making false statements as a lawyer or as a witness. And the court system, regardless of what the political affiliation is of the judges who are appointed, the legal culture in America is so strong that it really doesn't matter what your political affiliation is. When you become a judge, you are not going to tolerate false statements. Again, in the main, there's always exceptions, but I think we showed that to ourselves and to the country, maybe in a way that people didn't fully recognize. There's a reason that the false claims were defeated all over this country, because judges said, courtroom's open, bring it. You'll get a fair hearing, bring it. And there was no there, and so the rule of law held. I don't know what to make, I don't know what the result will be of the criminal case in the Manhattan DA's office against former President Trump, but what I love about it is, that's what the rule of law looks like. You go to a grand jury, get a charging document, it's presented in open court, the defendant has an attorney, it's gonna get discovery, there's a judge. This is what the rule of law is in America, and it's so wonderful that the American people see it after so long having leaders like Donald Trump take a flamethrower to it. So one of the reasons I'm optimistic is I know culture is hard to change. Thank goodness. Because the legal culture of this country, the culture in the FBI, the culture in the military, the culture in our U.S. intelligence community is so rooted down to bedrock that we are apolitical in our exercise of power. We do not tolerate nonsense. That it has been and it will be our saving grace.
Right.
I hope we won't need to test it again, but it'll be our saving grace.
I want to, before we go to Q&A, I want to read. This is your prosecutor and investigator talking about truth. And at one point, Nora says, it's about finding the truth. That's what this job is supposed to be about, right? And Benny says, it is, but in a messed up world, it's also about making sure the bad guys don't get away. And she says, we can do both. But I almost hear, just in reading that, I hear the doubt in her voice. we can do both. Can we do both?
No, she's, that doubt is me there, that I've seen enough to know that bad guys sometimes get away. And for reasons that I understand, some are important structural reasons. We've set the system up in such a way. Some are because rich people, powerful people have an ability to shape processes so that they get away. Right? I can't tell you the number of prosecutors I've encountered who are intimidated by rich people with credentialed lawyers. I can remember saying to my people when I was the U.S. attorney, saying, what, are they going to hit you? I mean, what is it you're worried about? Well, what tends to shape them is they want to go out and work in that world. Oh. And are worried about, I remember when they were coming in saying, I would commit the worst offense in the world if I indicted Martha Stewart. And by the way, I thought that's what hate was, but I came to learn that hate, that was just a pimple on the hate I would experience. but that part of it was, we are part of a club, we well-connected, powerful law firm people, and you don't want to go sideways with us. And so it really is true that the quality of justice can vary in direct proportion to the quality and influence of your attorney. And so there's a sense in which, so it's more to this notion that sometimes bad people get away. But I'm not cynical about it. I've learned to see that gray, and I'm trying to capture that there. And there's probably more of me in the voice of Benny Dugan, the organized crime investigator, who sees the darkness.
Right, and he's based loosely on someone you actually worked with?
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah. Another labor of love in writing this, I worked with a guy named Kenny McCabe, who was 6'5", 250 pounds of Brooklyn, and thick accent, booming voice, and a great investigator, the best I've ever seen. And I became very close with him as a line prosecutor, and then when I became the U.S. attorney. And he died in 2006, way too young. And I have tried to capture him there. And I've actually used the banter he would have with me. Mm. He called me Mr. Smooth. And so I called him Mr. Rough. And then he would say, you know, I'm not as good a person as you think I am. And I would say, what makes you think that I think you're a good person? And so we would have this banter. And this is a true story. A week ago, I was in the basement organizing stuff in my house in Virginia. And I saw, when I left as a line prosecutor, they gave me one of these ridiculous caricature sketches. And they had everybody who'd worked on the case sign on the mat. And on the mat, I can see he's written, Mr. Smooth, the good guys will miss you, and so will I. And then he signed it. And I've tried to capture this sense that he had this feeling like he lives in more of a borderland, that he has to work so closely with these guys in Cosa Nostra that he's gotten some of it on him. And so I'm over here, he's in the middle in a way, and he would sort of be protective of me in that way. And I don't think he was fair to himself, but I've tried to capture that spirit. And I wrote in the acknowledgments that I hope his family can feel him in these pages, even though this is fiction.
Well, I mean, the story you just told is reflected here. And you did capture that, the give and take between the prosecutor and he.
And he was also, which I've also tried to capture, this big bear of a man was colorblind. And so all of us who are friends with him, every time he testified, we would ask some unplanned question that called for him to identify something by color. And so I can remember in court, the true story, in courtroom 318, same courtroom my little girl grew up to prosecute in, he was on the stand for me, and I said, Mr. McCabe, by the way, Mr. McCabe, what color was that vehicle? And he looks at me like he's just going to kill
me. He knows,
me.
Yeah.
And he looks at me and says, I don't know. I'm colorblind. And so he comes off the stand, and he walks behind me, and I'll give you the exact quote. He says, bunch of fucking comedians. And then slides behind me into his chair. To be able to relive that and to picture my beloved friend is a joy. And I hope readers will feel him in the same way.
Well, we're going to go to some questions, but is this your future now, writing?
Yeah, this is what I want to do when I grow up.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
All right, well, it's a great start. It's a great start. All right, this is questions from our audience. Why did you decide to start writing fiction? Do you enjoy it more than nonfiction?
First I said I wasn't going to do it. My second book was a collection of stories from cases I had done, different stories than this, but stories to try and illustrate the principles that should undergird the Department of Justice. Because at that point, Bill Barr was the Attorney General, Donald Trump was the President, and I was really worried that especially young people would lose sight of how it's supposed to be. And so I told stories, and the editor said, he would say, this scene and that scene, and I would say, dude, that's not a scene, that's my life, right? That happened. And he would say, yeah, but you write narrative well, you write dialogue really well, it's really interesting, you should write fiction. I said no. And then he pitched the idea of me doing it with somebody, an established writer, and I said, no, I've loved to write my whole life. I love to write. If I did it, I would do it myself, but no. But what happened to me is the farther I got from the government, the easier it became to think about this. I always had a hard time watching TV shows about the work and reading about it. Anything about terrorism, espionage, or crime. But the farther I got from that world, the easier it became to think about it. So I decided to give it a shot, and my wife pitched this story, and I started writing it and found it addictive. Harder than nonfiction, but more fun. Yeah. Harder because nonfiction is just about something happened. You got to get it right. Yeah. And so I'm checking transcripts and memos and then write it in an interesting way. But imagination is forbidden. And fiction is the reverse. Yeah. It didn't happen. And so you have to imagine it and keep it straight. And that's where I got real help, especially from my spouse. Because she would say, you know, Benny's voice is drifting. And of course I would say, no, it's not. And then I would realize she was right and fix it.
Second question is actually a pretty good follow-up. Did working with Trump cause you to gain a greater respect for fiction? Somebody asked.
That's what I love about Philadelphia. Funny people. I'll tell you, though, so maybe in a sense, working with Trump caused me to obsess on the danger to our country if we stop measuring our leaders by their tether to the truth. And my worry during the Trump era, which we're still living in, but especially when he was president, was that we'll be so overwhelmed, right? There has to be a touchstone, and all leaders make false statements, and we grade them by, what do they mean, right? I remember President Obama said, if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor. And that turned out not to be true. And so what did all of us do? We'd say, well, what did he mean? And what was he thinking when he said that? And he said, well, I didn't mean, I thought. And so we forced him to explain himself. My worry was the wave of lies would be so great that it would wash away that touchstone, and we would just stop trying to measure our leaders by that. And so my obsession became making sure that I said, the truth is a real thing. It exists. And we have to measure our leaders by their tether to it. And so, yeah, in a way, the avalanche of fiction had an effect on me in a big way.
This is a question about your writing process. What's the best way you've found to organize your plot direction?
Well, I'll tell you how I do it, and I don't know whether this is the best way, but working with my wife, who, as I said, has great story vision, we agree on an entire story. So the arc of the whole story. Here's how it starts, here's how it ends, and then who the characters will be. And we debate that. And then so what I do is once we've had these conversations, I then go away and write a summary of the story and a bio of each of the characters. And then she looks on it on a Google Doc and gives me loving and painful feedback. And then I iterate, and then we get to a place where I get no more feedback, and I said, okay, that's it. And then the trick that she's taught me is, once I have the whole story, the next question is, what parts will be behind that curtain and what won't? And when will we show? And I've not read a lot of fiction, for reasons that I said, but she's read everything, and she has lots of pet peeves on these things, and one of them is when she feels tricked. Like, you didn't give me a chance to figure this out. you hid stuff, you walked something on at the end, it fell from the sky. And so she's taught me, my obsession has to be, what will peek out under that curtain and when, so that when you get to the end and see how it ends, I have fooled you, but in a fair way. Where you're like, nope, he gave me a chance, yeah. I missed it. And so it helps me to have the whole story and then try to figure out what to show. I know a lot of great writers, and I'm not a great novel writer, but a lot of great writers say that they start at the beginning not knowing where they're going to go, and then write and get to the destination. And I, at least so far, I haven't been able to do that. I've written this one, which I really enjoyed, written a second one, which is now out getting loving feedback from my family members, and done it both the same way, starting with a conception of the whole thing and then figuring out what to show. And then, of course, the trick for me that my wife can't help with is I have to figure out where to put the scenes and how the scenes should sound, what the dialogue should be like, because she doesn't know those places right. and those people the way that I do, but she helps me with that skeleton.
Is the second novel going to revisit some of the same characters?
Yes. Yeah. Nora Carlton is going to be at the center of the second one. I worked for 3 years before, I never thought I'd go back to government, and before President Obama asked me to come and be FBI director, I worked for 3 years as the general counsel of the world's largest hedge fund. And so I want to show people that world in a crime novel, hopefully without getting sued by my former employer, but fictionalize it because it's really interesting and fun to tell a story there. And so it'll be Nora, and you'll see Benny again. Yeah. My publisher said I can't talk about the third book, but it'll be New York-based because he doesn't want me giving away what happens to characters.
Okay. Do you have any advice for rookie prosecutors?
Yeah, I do, because I was one, and I taught a lot of them. I used to bring in new prosecutors on their first day when I was U.S. attorney, and I'd ask them to bring their family, the people closest to them, because I want them to hear my expectations and because I want to make an imprint on them. And I would say, okay, here are my expectations. The first is that you will recognize that I am about to give you power and responsibility all out of proportion to your actual ability. Right? You are 27 years old. I am about to give you the power to ruin people's lives. Never forget that. Use that with humility. Ask questions. Be afraid that you're wrong. Learn. Because injustice happens, at least in my experience, not from intentional wrongdoing by prosecutors or investigators, but by people who have allowed the confirmation bias and overconfidence to cabin the way they see something. That's how terrible injustice happens. And so I love this expression, trust only the one who doubts. And so I would try and drill that into these kids. And then I would say, I also expect you to remember the stress in this work will eat you alive if you're not careful. It'll drip in you like an acid. And so I expect you to do the following. I expect you to sleep. I expect you to love somebody. Right? There's a disease in the legal business in particular, get-back-itis, where you tell yourself, I'm trying to rescue the taken. Right? I'm doing really important work. I'll get back to my, and then fill in the blank. And I tell these kids in front of their families, I said, your mom and dad will not be there. Your two-year-old will never be two again. Do not miss that. It's both the right thing to do, and it's also good for you, because stress will compromise your ability to use this power wisely. And then I would say with a smile, but hey, here's good news. You can multitask. You can sleep with people you love. And they all look at me like, what is wrong with this guy? But so my advice is similar to people, that remember your power. Remember that your client is not your boss. It's not the district attorney. It's not the U.S. attorney. It's not the investigator you're working with. It's an idea, which is why it's so cool to be a prosecutor. You don't have a client. I've been a criminal defense lawyer. That's terrifying because I'm responsible for helping this person. Your job as a prosecutor is to represent justice. And so it's not about wins and losses. I don't care about wins and losses. I care about you having done the right thing. Never forget that. And then I would send them away.
Yeah, good advice. John Meacham says many times, In history, events test our Constitution. Do you think this is one of those times?
Yes. I think we've been tested in a lot of different ways, tremendously. We were tested on January 6th in ways I couldn't have imagined, frankly. And we passed our test, but we didn't dunk on the test, right? We didn't pass it overwhelmingly. And if things continue on their current course, all of that will be on the ballot in 2024. And so I respect differences about policy. It's important to have differences about policy and to debate it in a respectful way and to advocate for things that we believe. But we have in common the core principles of this republic of ours. And it's not about policy choices. It's existential. And so that will be on the ballot in 2024, again, if things continue the way they appear to be. And so I hated having to participate in the political process in 2020, in the sense that I went all around and talked. I talked to universities. I tried to motivate people to vote. And it's the reason I could never again lead an organization like the FBI, because I was a partisan. And I did it on purpose, because I thought I won't be able to look at my grandchildren if I could have done something and I didn't do it. And so my worry is that we're all tired. We've been through a very difficult time with the pandemic. We've all suffered. And do we have the energy to engage again? We better. We better. Because the challenge is as great, and I actually think the stakes are higher. I'm not given to hyperbole. And so my worry is that the American people won't see it. And people criticize CNN for the town hall they had, and I get that. I thought it was wonderful, because I want the American people to stare at it, stare at what's on the ballot. And again, I respect, I'm sure we have differences about how we feel about taxes or any, this isn't about that. This is about something above that. And I just want to make sure we all focus on it. So I will probably try and make a marginal difference if I can next year as well.
This is a question, I saw you address this yesterday on the Nicole Wallace Show. If you had not announced the reopening of the Clinton investigation, how would that have played out? What would have been the repercussions?
I don't know. Obviously, I've tried to live that imaginary life 1,000 times. The way I was sitting, I saw two choices at that point. And my judgment, which honestly it still is in hindsight, as painful as that is that to choose not to say something at that point would have been catastrophic to the Justice Department, to the FBI, and I think more broadly than that. And the reason I say that, it's important to understand the context of that, is I had just spent the entire summer defending against vicious attacks from the Republicans that the FBI was crooked, that we'd given Hillary Clinton a break. And we had not. As I explained when I tried to offer transparency, we did a professional investigation. There was no there. And I went and testified under oath repeatedly, this thing's done. You can trust us. We're the FBI. Go away. Go have an election. Leave the Hillary Clinton thing over. That's done. And the Attorney General testified in the same way. And then I find out on October 27th, the evening of the 20th, day of the 27th, that not only is it not over, but my team's telling me it's not over in a way where the result may change. And we have found a trove of emails like nothing we ever saw before, and we can't possibly review them before the election. And so what do I do? And so the choice of not speaking is an action, because it's to allow the American people to go on an election based on a lie from the FBI that this is done, this is over. Of course, the other is also terrible. It's to speak, not literally speak. I didn't speak at all. I just sent a letter, private letter to Congress, which they leaked in like 8 seconds. But to tell Congress that the testimony I gave you repeatedly under oath is not accurate. Right, one of the norms of the Department of Justice is when I give false testimony as an employee, I fix it. I go and tell the tribunal. And so both of those are horrible, because we're on the cusp of an election. Oh, my God, is there another door? And I couldn't find another door. And so I still think, I mean, if you imagine an alternative life, had I not said something? And let's imagine the worst of all worlds. Again, because it's only what I know on October 28th. Our evaluation of the case changes so that after the election, we have a different view of Secretary Clinton's criminal culpability. And we knew that it had changed before the election, and we didn't say anything, even though we testified under oath to the contrary. Wow. And so reasonable people can see this differently, but both of those doors lead to hell. But that not speaking door, I don't know what it would do to a Hillary Clinton presidency. I don't know what it would do to the institutions of government, but it would destroy the FBI and the Justice Department. And so my job was to try and understand, given the values of this institution, what's the right thing to do, given my role in our government? And look, I wanted help. And so that's why I had my chief of staff call the Attorney General's chief of staff and say, here's what he thinks he has to do, but he'd welcome a conversation with you. And the answer came back, she disagrees, but she doesn't wish to speak to him. And look, I've been around. I knew what that was. That was, dude,
You're going under the bus.
You're taking this hit.
Yeah.
And that was part of my wife's agony, because she said, why you? Why does that have to be you? And I said, look, I could do, honestly, the chicken shit thing, and, I don't know, write a memo to the Attorney General and then leak it or something. But this is my job, to try and decide what the right thing to do is and then just do it. And I knew it was disastrous for me personally, in a way that the other one wouldn't have been for me personally. But you can't do that. You can't do that and look at your kids and your grandkids. So anyhow, I hate that I was involved. That Donald Trump was who he was causes me enormous pain. The notion that I was trying to engineer the election of Donald Trump to be president of the United States is as insane as that the FBI is a leftist organization. But I just didn't want to be involved, and there was no way not to be in the middle of it. So anyhow, sorry, that's too long.
No. Last question. How do you feel about the lack of trust and blatant disdain towards our judicial system?
I worry about it. And some of it is self-inflicted by members of our judiciary, but some of it is purely external, where people, again, they're not saying it in a courtroom, but saying it outside courtrooms to try and pretend that our judges are partisan actors, when in the overwhelming main, they're not. It's another attack on the rule of law. I mean, it's of a piece with trying to take a flamethrower to the FBI. And the reason is obvious, because of the perceived threat coming from that direction. If you can beat the credibility of the FBI into the ground, if you can beat the Department of Justice into the ground, if you can beat judges into the ground, then when they come for you, you've already prepped that battlefield. I mean, it's obvious. And so I think, again, it's really important that those of us who know better speak up. And I think the legal profession's doing a decent job here of speaking up, but the bar associations and whatnot don't have the megaphone that some of the attackers do. But I think of it as the same way as the rest of the attacks. We're going to be okay as long as we participate. And I like to think about Abraham Lincoln, like to quote Seward, who was his Secretary of State, right? Have I got that right? Seward apparently told Lincoln that there's enough virtue during the Civil War, there's enough virtue in America to save America. And then he paused and said, but always just enough. And look, we make it closer than it has to be, but there's enough virtue. I as people of my age and your age here, I bore my children, and I hope I'll get to bore my grandchildren, telling them about when I was a little boy, my country was coming apart. When I was a little boy, the president was murdered in broad daylight, and his brains were on his wife's pink dress. And then his brother was likely to be the next member of his family to be president, and he was murdered in Los Angeles. And Martin Luther King was murdered, and Malcolm X was murdered, and our cities were burning down. And there were bombings literally every day in my beloved country. And thousands of boys were dying in the jungles in a war that we didn't understand, and thousands of others were fleeing to Canada to avoid that fate. My country was coming apart, and it didn't, because there's enough virtue to save America. And so we'll be okay, and I tell the younger people this because I know America. There's enough virtue to save this country so long as those of us who are the repository of that virtue defend that virtue in that country. So thank you for caring about that.
That's a good note to end. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.